Scott, for those of you that are here to hear a non-Gaussian infiltration problem, you're really going to hear one non-Gaussian one, because I don't even have an equation in my presentation to you. And a lot of us will think that art, based on what we have heard so far, that they really had done a lot of work in analytical or numerical, mathematical part of the soil physics. But he really has had a lot to do with actual field and lab experiments. And he was as comfortable working with me looking at salt movement from animal waste soil mixture as he was comfortable doing non-point source, from point sources, line sources, and all those that Dave presented to you. He had students that worked on a spatial variability, looking at variability of soil properties across field. They collected a lot of samples and analyzed those. And he had a student looking at sample size effect on soil properties. He had a student looking at nitrogen distribution over fields. So he's not really doing things that are mathematically oriented. And one of the things that Scott mentioned that he always was looking at the practical applications of some of these things, and I had a lot of fun. They've showed you a set of monographs that we developed based on these equations, and that was a lot of fun. But at the same time, he really was looking into practical applications of it. I went to his office in January of 1972. I introduced myself to him as his new graduate student in soil physics. I left in 1983. I was in the University of Arizona for 11 years. I worked with him and I worked for him, and didn't make any difference. He was always treated me with respect, and I really appreciate what Art has done for his students. And when I went to North Carolina State University, I totally moved away from all these modelings, and although I still have my love for modeling and mathematical approaches, but I'm presenting to you some basically experimental results that I believe would be interesting to you. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors on this one, Chris Neuner. He was my technician, now he works for someone else in my department. He did a lot of the field work, and David Limbo, who's been working with me on septic systems. Basically, when we talk about either a trench or an auger hole, when we look at, we put water in there, under ideal condition, we think that water is going to move out of the hole in the fashion that you see in there. We refer to these as the streamlines. And then if you take a bunch of lines that are perpendicular to those, and those lines will be presenting basically equipotential lines. And when we model these things, we have, if you have got multiple of these sources, we can say, okay, you have got lines of symmetry in their mirror images. So we basically look at an area of this and we model that part and see how everything works. But that's really an ideal situation, ideal conditions, that we don't have it in the fields, under field conditions. Basically, when we do modeling, we make a couple of assumptions. Number one, that we always make the assumption that Darcy's law is valid, although there are some cases that Darcy's law may deviate from the way that we think about it. And the other one is that we assume that the soil under consideration is homogeneous and isotropic. And the reason we make those assumptions is because we need to simplify the system as much as possible. We have enough problem solving those equations, thanks to Dave, and he used to do a lot of these analytical solutions, and he will solve them. I will run into computer center, run those Fortran programs with those decks of cards, and come back and we talk about it and manipulate or work on it again. So we have to make all these assumptions to be able to do those things. Even the numerical solutions, you have to make assumptions. The objective that I have in here basically present to you a field assessment of university of water flow from auger holes and trenches through soils. I'm going to talk about two sets of experiments. One was water flow from cylindrical holes, and the other one was water flow from trenches in different soils. The first one, three-dimensional water flow from cylindrical hole. Basically what we put water in the hole, and as that water moves away from the hole, we generate basically different zones of saturations around that hole, And based on the infiltration, basically, that we can see, we have a zone of saturation, a zone of transmission, wetting front, and wetting zone, and wetting front. Conducted a set of experiments. So we dug auger holes about 50 centimeters apart at one soil along a line. And we used a constant head permeameter. We measured hydraulic conductivity in those six holes. And then we put a dye in those holes and see what they are. And then we excavated the holes and see where the dye has gone in those soils. And here are basically the cross-sectional area. We did that in different soils. This is a BT horizon. That's about 70% clay content, has a very well structured. This is what we refer to as C-cell soil series. This is the soils of North Carolina, actually, a state soil. It's very common in the southeastern United States, and it's one of the best soils that we have for not only agriculture, for housing development, for installing septic systems, for example. We measure hydraulic conductivity along in all those six holes, and these are the numbers that we got for those. You see that the distance between those holes, 50 centimeters, the first reading 5.3, 1.2, 4.3, 1, 7, 12.2. So you see that you have got an order of magnitude right within, about 3 meters distance in there, or 2.5 meters distance in there. So extreme level of variability that we have in those soils. And then we'll look at the dye movement, and the ones on your right-hand side are basically two different BT horizons that you see in there, or different holes, number one and number three holes that we have, and then on the right-hand side of you is what we refer to as saprolite. You don't have it in this area, perhaps, but if you move up a little bit southeastern, or even in California, if we have, which is defined as rock that has decomposed without losing basically volume. It has lost mass but without any volume. It's very soft, very friable material in those systems. You do not find any macropores in those other than some maybe fractures that are filled and are no longer working. And you will see in here that in the BT horizon that you see a lot of macropore water movement, that you see all those blue points in those pictures. That it doesn't tell you that the water moves through basically the system that we think about it, that we have a saturation zone, a transition zone, a wetting front. The one on your right-hand side, on the other hand, you probably can say, okay, I can assume that I have a sort of a uniform and homogeneous flow through that soil system. This was done for the auger hole in another experiment. We looked at the water movement from trenches. We conducted four experiments in three different soils. One side we conducted in the A and E horizon and also in the BT horizon. So two of the experiments were in an A and E horizon, two of them were in the BT horizons, that the clay soils. We applied 50 liters of water every day to these for more than 15 days. So there were four trenches. Each one got 50 liters of water. We let that water go in there, and then we came back next day and added 50 liters. We did that one for anywhere from 50 days to over 70 days. At one side, we did it over 70 days. After that, we switched to a 50 liter of a solution that contained 5 millimoles of KBR and 500 milligram per liter of a brilliant blue dye, basically as a tracer dye. And we applied that one also, 50 liters for 15 days or so. And then at the end of that, we dug a trench perpendicular to all these trenches, and we looked at the dye movement and basically the sampling. So here schematically, we had the four trenches. Each one of those trenches had a dosing device that we applied water to these trenches. What we refer to these in North Carolina and other places, those are you familiar with septic system. This is called the low pressure pipe distribution system. So the water was distributed through those holes that you see orifices in this trench fairly uniformly. And then after that, we applied the dye. And then at the end of that experiment, we dug a trench perpendicular to it, and we looked at basically the two walls on the trench to see where the dye and bromide has gone. Here is the experimental setup, one of them, and you see that we were on about maybe 5% cider slope, and those are the four individual dosing devices. We also had observation wells, we had TDR, we had potentiometers and neutron probes and looking at the water movement in addition to just looking at the di and bromide movement. But what I will show you would be basically the di and the bromide. And here is a big trench that we dug perpendicular to one of these trenches. In this picture, what you see is that we have the trench, and you see at the bottom of that trench, fairly a square trench, and you see the di area in there, but then after that, you don't find basically right around the trench much di area. You see that you have got some places in here that water has moved through macropores, and you see the di areas in those macropores. This was when the trench was installed in the BT horizon, whereas when the trench was installed in the ANE horizon, which is basically fairly sandy material, coarse texture material, you see that we have a fairly uniform die movement right around the trench and not much moving into that clay horizon. And basically what happens at these side slopes is that the water that goes in there, that die gets absorbed to the soil. But we find out that water has basically moved away from right at the boundary between that AE horizon and the BT material right around and moved away from the area, and that was we show basically with our die movement. And here is another picture that you see that even about a meter and a half, 2 meters away from the system, we have these macropores that have conducted water from this trench. And this one is just a picture of one of those macropores that you see that hot dye has come through this macropore and is staying right around the macropore area. It does not mean that water has not moved into the matrix, but that dye gets highly absorbed into the soil, so it gets absorbed and doesn't move too far away. It does not mean that water did not move into the soil matrix. At the end of when we evaluated the dye movement, we installed, basically looked at the a grid system. We collected sample from one, the middle of each one of those grids. Those grids were about 20 centimeters apart. And we looked at the movement of dye or bromide in there. And here what you see is that you see from 0 to 25 milligram per kilogram to anywhere from 150 plus milligram per liter. This is the trench that was installed in the BT horizon. So the bottom of the trench was in the BT horizon. We see right under the trench that we have a high level of bromide transport, but then right on the side, very close to it, we have 0 to 25, whereas when you look at the bottom, that is 30 centimeters to the right, at about 220 centimeters below the trench, that we have something like 25 to 50 milligram per liter, and even higher at 75 to 100 milligram per liter bromide movement. So we see that once this trench, when this trench was installed in the BT horizon, that's how bromide moved out of it. And when we did the mass balance on this one, we all recovered about 90% of that bromide that was applied. We found that it was basically within the soil that we recovered. When the trench was in the AE horizon, above that BT horizon, we see that not a lot of the material of bromide moved within the soil. It moved very little, moved into the soil. And we even did not find a lot of that bromide right there on the trench. And we feel that what happened was that bromide, because it was on a side slope, it got into at that boundary and started moving away from it without even being captured by dye or by bromide observation. This is nothing new, but it's another indication that the soils are highly variable. If you read some of Art's work back in, and I think it's Applied Advanced Soil Physics book that Dan Hillel published back in early 1980s, he has an article about it, and with Don Nielsen talk about soil variability in there to some extent. And they talk about that the K-sat is highly variable. So we know that the saturated K is highly variable, and we showed that even within about 2.5 meters, you can have an order of magnitude difference in the conductivity. Basically, in the sandy texture soil, water basically moves in the inner particle pores. We define the inner particle pores, pores that are between soil particles. Whereas in the clay soil, it moves through the macropores in there that are either root channels or planar voids, which are structural voids between soil pads. Basically, since most of our models, we assume that we have a homogeneous and isotropic situation, we also need to consider these conditions that, you know, some of these are not really the field conditions that you will observe, but if you consider those, like Scott mentioned during his last talk, that he's developed some simple mathematical models or equations or way to
come up with some way that we can explain what happens in the field, and that's what we really need to do. And again, thanks to Art, he instilled in me the appreciation for soil physics, not only for modeling, also for what really is in the field, and I thank him for it. And with that, I stop. If you have any question, I'll be glad to answer.
Question?
Yes.
How did we do bromide
concentration? Did we measure bromide? We collected soil sample, we extracted them, we analyzed the bromide by ICP, I believe it is. Right. Or I shouldn't say ICP, but our analytical lab did the analysis for us. We used to use electrodes, but we stopped doing